This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As someone who spent 6 years covering Capitol Hill and the White House, I can tell you that official Washington likes to call things by weird names. Names that serve political purposes. Take, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act.
With the Inflation Reduction Act, this Senate Democratic majority has achieved what countless others have come to Washington promising to do, but ultimately failed to deliver.
Okay, fine, Chuck Schumer, whatever you say. The truth is, this bill is about climate change, no matter what Senate Democrats had to call it to get West Virginia's Joe Manchin on board. So you could give this thing a few other names.
I mean, there's the Manchin Made This Take a While Act.
That's Pranchu Verma, who covers innovation for The Washington Post. He was gracious enough to play along with my congressional bill naming free association exercise.
There's the crazy sci-fi Green Tech Is Coming Upon Us Act. I'm kind of curious what you think.
Could you call it a carbon reduction act, or is it more of like, here's some cool carbon tech act?
Yeah, you could call it a carbon reduction act. You could call it an alternative energy act. You could call it. I mean, frankly, you could also try to, you know, there's so much with electric vehicles in there.
Mm.
Electrical vehicle modernization or affordable electrical. Ugh.
That really rolls off the tongue.
That doesn't work. That doesn't work. Inflation Reduction Act is better than that option. Yeah, for sure. Okay, I'm done naming bills on my end. I'm fired from that job.
But in Pranchu's day job, which is to report on new technology and innovation, he sees this bill as a potential game changer, something that can take climate change technology and supercharge it.
You know, this is unparalleled levels of investment, specifically for climate change. I mean, I know that there were proposals to fund far more and give money far more to climate technology and climate change solutions, but the $370 billion roughly is still the single largest, you know, investment from the U.S. government in history to stem global warming. So, and the way it's being done, it does seem to have a shot at being very transformative, I would say.
So today on the show, the Climate Tech Gets a Lot More Money and Maybe Changes the Planet Act. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined, no matter what you call it. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
You can think about climate tech as any type of technology that helps mitigate climate change, from electric vehicle charging stations to sustainable batteries, solar energy to direct air carbon removal. It's a hot sector, no pun intended. The accounting firm PwC says there are 78 private climate tech companies worth over $1 billion. The Inflation Reduction Act is not the first time the government has plunked a significant amount of money into climate technology. Back in 2009, President Obama's stimulus bill contained $90 billion to promote clean energy. Some of that fizzled, most notably with the failed solar company Solyndra. Other technologies of that era, Pranchu says, just weren't ready for prime time or weren't cheap enough for widespread adoption. But since then, the tech has gotten better and more attractive to investors.
And so now, you know, we're having a second generation attempt at this. And a lot of it is being driven by government investment, no doubt. And then also, you know, the business case kind of became more apparent. And venture capitalists have now taken a lot of, you know, ownership in the space for better and for worse. But there is a lot of venture capital money kind of flowing in to, you know, supplement the government cash to research and develop solutions. And you're starting to see, you know, a few kernels of like themes coming up of like places where climate tech is really advancing.
How does the Inflation Reduction Act do this? Like, what are the mechanisms?
They're tax credits, really, and just raw dollars for research and development, I would say, that really are the two main mechanisms through which you'll see climate technology companies get bolster and get funding for some of their solutions or make it more of a business case to go and do their solutions and try and invest and make, you know, some gains in some of their technology that they're testing out.
One thing that's notable here is that the clean energy landscape in which the government is making these investments is pretty different from what it was back in the early 2000s.
The raw cost to do it is getting cheaper, right? Because of the scientific innovations, the process innovations, it's still expensive, but it is cheaper. And there's a more feasible business case for like, hey, I create this thing that is going to create wind or solar power and distribute it to millions of people. But doing it at a cost that's affordable to the individual consumer or to a state that wants to use this was really never that possible. But because of the technological gains, because of some of the process gains over the past decade, spurred in part by government research and investment and other research and investment, it's now becoming more and more possible. Still needs more work. And I think this is where the IRA comes in, where it spurs and jolts this next level of innovation to get more process gains and to get it cheaper and to get it into a place where it becomes feasible in a time scale that we need, which is, you know, right now.
Climate tech takes money, often big chunks of it right up front for research and investment. And that, theoretically, is where this bill comes in. Pranchu has a good analogy.
Climate technology is not unlike pharmaceuticals and biotechnology, right? Like you have, when you think about it, when you need to make a medicine, you have no idea if it's going to work. And so you need to pour a lot of money in, and it costs, right, they say like billions of dollars to make that first pill and then 5 cents to make every pill after. Like climate tech is kind of like that. Like until you figure out an energy solution that actually works, it takes billions of dollars to get there. But once you perfect it, then you can make it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But we're still in that phase where we need a lot of money for these climate tech solutions. And so, you know, the investors are getting more and more lured in as the government is becoming more and more a partner in some of these places.
I'd love to take a couple of pieces of kind of the most promising technology and really dig into them. What stands out to you? What are the buckets that you're looking at?
There's carbon capture, I think, and alternative energy. And within alternative energy, there's geothermal energy and green hydrogen and nuclear fusion energy that I think are, you know, you see some of these buckets really becoming more common and more getting more attention nowadays. But, I would definitely say the thing we'll probably see first out of any of those will probably be things called carbon capture systems.
And carbon capture systems, we've reported on this show before, essentially they suck carbon out of the air, either actively or passively or semi-passively. How does this bill prop up carbon capture?
So before this bill passed, companies that captured carbon out of the air would get $50 per ton of carbon they captured out of the air. as a tax credit from the government. And to qualify for that tax credit, they needed to capture at least 100,000 tons of carbon out of the air. That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. This bill, instead of that $50 per ton, now companies will get $180 per ton for every ton of carbon they capture out of the air. And to qualify for this credit, they no longer have to have a big project that's 100,000 tons of carbon. Now they can have something as low as 1,000 tons of carbon.
And do the companies that you have talked to and the industry people you've talked to, is that attractive to them?
It is. I talked to a host of CEOs of carbon capture systems. And carbon capture systems, it's still unclear to me how much they actually cost on the market, because I think the CEOs are still developing that actual business case and business model. But they're not on the order of billions, but they're on the order of millions, right? And it roughly costs about $400 to $600 to operate a carbon capture system for every ton of carbon. And so now if you think about that, $400 to $600 in operating costs per ton of carbon, if the government's only giving you $50 per ton back, you know, you got to make sure your price point, you know, you got to make up that money somehow.
Right. You got to charge a lot.
You got to charge a lot. Now, $180, that is the level of difference that, you know, our CEOs are saying they can now go to, not just philanthropies, you know, like a Bill Gates philanthropy or something, but they can go to venture capitalists. They can go to outside money raisers and they can say, look, we're now getting more money from the government. We have a better business case to say we're going to get returns in the future because we're getting more support from the government. For them, the banking is that, you know, they get to the path where they can mainstream this technology. But right now, that's really helpful to lure in some outside cash for these companies who are, you know, it's a cash intensive business.
What other technology is getting a big lift from this bill?
You know, I think nuclear fusion is going to be another one that we see get a pretty big lift of attention from this bill. It's really interesting because nuclear fusion has always been considered the holy grail of energy, right? It's harnessing the energy from two nuclear atoms when they're splitting, harnessing that energy, which is very hard to harness, and then using that to create an alternative source of energy. And this can be unlimited and clean. And yet it's scientifically been nearly, you know, not impossible, but very science fiction-y to consider it, mainstream. But again, like in the past 5 to 6 years specifically, you've seen nuclear fusion reach a few milestones with a few companies. And again, the money that's coming from this act, you know, that's going to invest, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in continued research is going to be what I think is needed to bring this technology and solve some of the last minute research problems that these companies are having to bring it to scale.
And then I think the thing that is on the market or seems most close to being on the market in a widespread way, obviously, is electric vehicles. What does the bill do there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think ultimately what the bill does is that it makes billions in tax credits available to make electric vehicles cheaper for the consumer to buy.
And then this is an investment. This is you and me going and buying cars.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not just like, let me invest in the technology. It's like, let me invest in making it cheaper to buy these solutions.
When we come back, is government money for clean tech just a climate change band-aid?
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
What is the one most important thing our society needs?
That would be harsher punishment for parole violators, Stan. And world peace.
Okay, we get it. World peace might seem like a pipe dream. But what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world. And in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Like anyone who spends their time thinking and writing about innovation, Pranchu got pretty excited talking about the weird stuff in this bill. Technologies that would no doubt be helpful fighting climate change, but still feel kind of sci-fi or even borderline impossible.
I mean, I do think the most experimental thing I've heard and we reported on was this thing called, which I kind of love, it's called super hot rock energy. And I mean, you know, if you think about it, the Earth generates a lot of heat, right? And it's theoretically limitless. And so we've used the Earth's heat before, right? It's called geothermal energy. So we've used the Earth's heat before to harness it and use it to make power. But it's never been at a powerful enough scale and done widespread enough throughout the world to really make such a dent. And so now you have scientists that are really trying to go deep, deep, deep down into the Earth, like 9 miles deep, deeper than anyone has ever gone before, you know, to go to a point where the Earth reaches about 750 degrees Fahrenheit. And so they want to drill a hole all the way down there. And then they want to pour and pump water all the way down there. And then they want that water to turn into like a really potent energy-filled steam and then pump that energy back up, that steam back up into the Earth's ground, put it through a turbine and make it, you know, a source of power, you know? Hmm. And so that is theoretically, again, limitless source of energy and nearly zero carbon emissions through that process. But just to give you a scale of the challenge, the science actually isn't the challenge here in this one. It's really the engineering. I think the most anyone has ever drilled deep underground is a Russian team in the 1980s, drilled about 7.5 miles deep underground, right? So you're saying now to make this type of energy theoretically possible, you got to go deeper than anyone's ever done. And they did it decades ago, right? So that challenge is really, really, you know, hard to see.
Another piece of pretty far out tech that gets some money in this bill would essentially put a carbon capture system on the back of a train car. The train's brakes would power it, and then it would suck carbon out of the air and store it in a reservoir on the train.
I mean, talk about sci-fi, right? Just the logistical issues of, you know, will train companies want to put carbon capture systems on their trains? The thousands and thousands of trains that would need to have carbon capture pods on them, you know, is that actually feasible to get to a level of like, you know, okay, we're making a dent in the environment and we're an active reason why we're getting to net zero emissions. And so, you know, who knows if that's actually going to happen, but it's definitely more in the field of consideration now, because I was just talking to the CEO of that company and he's like, look, I'm in a $10 million fundraising round right now. I need to develop a prototype by next year. And this is changing the game with my conversations because people are willing to put more money in there now. And so for him, you know, it's helpful to kind of have this environment where, you know, experimentation is being, you know, it's being actively thrived and given a jolt because of this bill.
Listening to you, you are actually making me think of processors, of the Pentagon's investment in computer processing chips and how government money spurred the commercial sector and the private sector to make faster and faster chips that are now, you know, cheap and easy and readily available to you and me. Do you think that's a fair analogy?
Yeah, I actually had not put that in my mind together, but hearing you say it, that is a great analogy. It's the tenet of what we're seeing here. It's you have a technology that's been, you know, up until a certain point, hard to master, and government money comes in at a time where makes it a little easier to master and process gains come in. And then you build a culture right from the universities to the investors, to the founders and the scientists, right? Like that's the important part, is you build this culture and communication with each other of innovation around climate technology that kind of feeds each other and then helps build process advancement quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. And like you said, with the processors, now you have where processors of 3 years ago, 3 months ago are seen relatively outdated with the level of pace of innovation. So let's hope that, you know, that kind of principle and that culture gets fostered in the climate technology space. I mean, we see the seeds of it. And can this be, you know, the catalyst? Let's you know, time will tell.
In terms of time, Pranchu says we won't really know if any of the tech jumpstarted by the Inflation Reduction Act is successful for at least a decade. And it might take even longer than that for it to bloom commercially. That's a lot of taxpayer money for something uncertain. At the same time, there's another criticism of clean tech, that it doesn't fundamentally alter the behaviors that led to global warming in the first place. One of the big knocks on carbon tech in general and things like direct air carbon capture is that they're band-aids, that they don't take enough carbon out of the atmosphere to make a significant dent in climate change. How much do these things move the needle, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so it's a complicated one, because when you talk to critics of carbon capture, they say this exact thing. They're like, well, all carbon capture is really doing is it's letting me emit as much as I want, but then letting me create solutions to just take that stuff out of the air, right? So it's like, okay, you know, I'm not changing my underlying behavior. And that's what really moves the needle. But that being said, for better or for worse, government has kind of is relying on carbon capture to achieve, you know, upwards of 10, 20% of net zero emission goals by 2050. So in the strategy of the government, it's a core component. But the theoretical reason for it, I think, gets a lot of critique because it's seen as something that's easy for industry to adopt because it's not shaking the boat for industry so much. It's just kind of throwing money at the problem.
Right. Like oil and gas companies get to keep doing what they want to do. And as long as they invest in carbon capture, no biggie.
They're set. Yeah. Which isn't right. And I feel comfortable saying that even as a journalist, because if you look at any sort of climate expert talk about the challenges ahead, I mean, you need more than band-aid solutions. You need whole level, systematic, ground up behavior change from everywhere, from companies to people. And you have to think about it. Well, if every dollar is precious, how much of those dollars should be sent to band-aid solutions versus spurring ground up behavior change solutions? And I think, you know, that's the tension that the government has because, you know, well, in actuality, the carbon capture systems might be a little bit more further along, right, than some of the more behavior change solutions of making systematic change on alternative energy sources.
I mean, I guess it's not unlike looking at the larger critique of this bill that has come from environmentalists who have said this isn't good enough, and other people looking at it and say, hey, man, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Every minute counts. And we're now at the point where just individual action alone is no longer considered feasible to stop the world from warming. Large level, systematic government level change is what's going to move the needle. And so this is definitely, you know, potentially moving the needle, but is it moving it enough? Who knows? And is it going to create an environment that makes it easier to move the, you know, perhaps pass more ambitious legislation in the future? who knows? Maybe this is as ambitious as it'll get. And then we'll basically, you know, see 30 years from now whether it really did much or not. Or does it spur a culture of innovation on climate technology and create more bills that help us get towards the progress? It's all kind of, you know, we'll have to see, you know, by 2030 and 2050. But 2030 is pretty close. And, you know, anything that can be, you know, given even an extra year of timeline because they have a little bit more money to make their solution market ready, you know, if it's a big enough solution, that can move the needle.
Pranjal Verma, thank you so much for your reporting and for talking with me.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure, Lizzie.
Pranjal Verma is an innovations reporter at The Washington Post. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell. Our show is edited by Tori Bosch. Joanne Levine is the executive producer for What Next, and Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. What Next TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we're also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. And if you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. Okay, we will be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.